My name is Tom Lee. I'm the Lutheran campus pastor at the University of Montana in Missoula, where from time to time I also teach an occasional course in the Religious Studies Department, principally courses in the Hebrew language and other related topics. I'm here this week to lead you in Bible study during this 9 o'clock hour from now through Saturday. The theme, as announced, is the Gospel for Exiles, studies in Isaiah 40 through 55. And the theme for this morning is I, Yahweh, will comfort you. And the text that we're going to be looking at in a few minutes is this passage here, Isaiah 40, 1 through 11. As the week progresses, we're going to move on and deal with some other themes from this part of the book of Isaiah. Tomorrow, the topic is I, Yahweh, am your creator, followed on Wednesday by I, Yahweh, am your savior. Those two themes really linked with each other, because for this prophet to talk about salvation for his people, for Israel, he must necessarily talk about creation. For this prophet, those two are linked. We cannot understand the action of God as Savior until we understand his activity as Creator. Those of you who may have been here last week, a session that Elmer did to introduce the village theme for the summer, he made reference to a quote from Joseph Sittler, where Sittler made the comment that for Christians today, we need to articulate or understand our doctrine of redemption or of salvation within the context of the doctrine of creation. Oftentimes, Lutherans especially have been caricatured as Unitarians of the second person of the Trinity. Over against that, we need to articulate our belief about Christ as Redeemer, as Savior, in that larger context of the activity of God as Creator. And that the linking of those two themes is something that I'm going to suggest Tuesday and Wednesday is essential to this particular prophet. Wednesday is Midsummer. And a lot of activities are planned for Wednesday evening and well into early Thursday morning. So I thought to see if we could get anybody here after all that night's activity, to get anyone here the following Monday morning, or following Thursday morning, I should have some kind of provocative title. So Thursday morning's theme is I, Yahweh, am your mother. And if you want to find out about that, come Thursday morning. Seriously, this prophet does develop some language and some imagery whereby Yahweh is described in mothering kinds of terms. The point here is that by this time, the time of the Babylonian exile, at least certain voices or certain thinkers in Israel we're beginning to sense that the traditional language of talking about the activity of Yahweh, where Yahweh was exclusively this male figure, the warrior deity, Israel's understanding of salvation was Yahweh as warrior who goes to battle against the forces that oppress his people. That kind of male language, that male image of Yahweh insufficient or inadequate to talk about Israel's total experience of who this God was. And so by bits and pieces we begin to see, particularly in this prophet, the use of language of mothering, of nurture, that Israel begins to develop with respect to Yahweh. So we're going to talk about that. But then also alongside of that, positing the prophet's description of Jerusalem or of Zion also in mothering kinds of terms as sort of a counterpoint to what we'll be talking about on Saturday, about the servant of the Lord, the servant figure, which for this prophet is a male figure, that you get this balance, this kind of point and counterpoint of the male servant and the mother of Zion, and Yahweh the warrior, the savior, and Yahweh the mothering figure. And so all that is intricately and poetically woven together by this prophet, who is a master, an absolute master of his language, the Hebrew language, and all the poetic possibilities that language offers. Friday, sort of the political dimension to Yahweh's act of saving his people. So the theme on Friday, I, Yahweh, anoint Cyrus. Cyrus, the great king, the great emperor of Persia, who becomes the instrument of Yahweh for the deliverance of his people. So those are the themes for the week. The intention is that we'll deal with each of those themes separately. They have their own integrity. So if you can't come to all, at least the hope is that you'll be able to take away something that has that can kind of hang together or have its own integrity. Certainly, I think to appreciate this prophet, if at all possible, I would encourage you to come to as many of the sessions as you are able to get an overview, a feeling for this particular prophet, who, for my money, is the high point of the Old Testament. That in these 16 chapters, we have a body of literature that with which there's nothing we can compare it. Now, some assumptions. I've selected out these chapters of Isaiah, 40 through 55, as a separate unit, a unit that has its own integrity, a unit that, at least my position is, ought to be considered apart from Isaiah 1 through 39 or Isaiah 56 through 66. Now, the division of Isaiah up into those three parts may be familiar to some of you, may not be familiar to others of you. To those of you that for whom this is unfamiliar territory, at first glance that may be sort of troubling. Sounds like I'm arbitrarily dividing up the book of Isaiah. If that troubles you, I hope you'll bear with me during these sessions and kind of reserve judgment until we're done on Saturday. So the assumption I'm making is that these chapters, 40 through 55, exist as a separate unit. They're the product of another person, not the Isaiah of Jerusalem, whom we meet in chapters 1 through 39, but are from the hand of a prophet who lived some years later, during the time of the Babylonian exile. That is the period, the exile is the period 587 to 538 BC. This prophet who gives us these chapters, beginning with chapter 40, our best guess is that he might be placed somewhere around the year 540 or in the late 540s BC, something like that. That raises a question. If this is a separate section, why then is it linked with the Isaiah of Jerusalem, chapters, his material, chapters 1 through 39? Well, there are some common themes that you can trace in both blocks of material, references to, say, a common phrase is the Holy One of Israel, designation of Israel's God by that title, that phrase, the Holy One of Israel. So there are things that tie them together, yet as we look at 40 through 55, there are things that cause us to mark them off as a separate product coming from yet a different time. And I hope those kinds of things will become evident as we work with these texts in the course of the week. So the assumption is these chapters from the time of the Babylonian exile, the product of another prophet, another Isaiah, whose name we do not know, we believe him to be, in a sense, a disciple of the first Isaiah, Isaiah of Jerusalem, because of some of those themes and some of those words and phrases that those blocks of material share in common. Biblical scholars are of the opinion that the prophets had groups of disciples, groups of students who perpetuated the traditions of their particular prophetic teacher. They were the ones that were responsible for collecting the sermons, collecting the oracles, editing them, transmitting them from generation to generation. And so one assumption is that the Isaiah whom we meet in 40 through 55 is in a sense a disciple of the Isaiah of 150 some odd years earlier. And then the last chapters in the book of Isaiah, 56 through 66, which seem to come from yet an even later time, after the time the Jews returned home to Jerusalem from exile, that those chapters are the products of disciples of this Isaiah of the exile. And so in those three sections, we see this kind of ongoing process of material preached by successive generations that stood in this prophetic tradition. Just as a sort of a footnote, the division of Isaiah into these parts is not something that I invented. It's not even something that modern biblical scholarship has invented. I think it's interesting to note that there was a famous Spanish rabbi from the Jewish community in Spain in the 12th century AD, a rabbi by the name of Ibn Ezra, who died in 1167 AD, that's a long time ago, that Ibn Ezra, as he read Isaiah, was of the opinion that more the work of Isaiah represents the work of more than one prophet. And so this figure from within the Jewish community, reading that text with that kind of sensitivity, kind of picked that out in the 12th century. More recently in the West, not long after the Revolutionary War, in the 1780s, a couple of German scholars were the first to kind of formulate the proposal that we must break Isaiah at chapter 40 and see chapter 40 and following as the product of a prophet who comes out of the time of the exile. So the separating off of what we call second Isaiah or Deutero-Isaiah is not a new fad or a new phenomenon by any means. Well, I made constant reference to the exilic context for these 16 chapters of Isaiah. So I'd like us to spend, before we turn to the text, I'd like us to spend a few moments just thinking about exile and about the significance that must have had for the people of Israel. Exile, I suppose, is something that you and I have never experienced. But maybe there are some things we have experienced or have some sense of that will enable us to begin, in a tentative way at least, to understand what the exile meant for the people of Israel. One thing that comes to mind within recent memory, within the last decade, is the experience of all those refugees from Southeast Asia. Those of us gathered here this morning, perhaps congregations to which we belong were congregations that were involved in sponsoring Indo-Chinese refugee families. And perhaps you had the opportunity of working with or aiding in the resettlement process or helping families adjust and make that transition to life in this country or in this culture. And if you can think of that, maybe that begins to give us some handle on what exile must be like, the plight of a refugee. Indochinese people who perhaps in South Vietnam or in Cambodia were influential persons, who were economically secure, who had positions of responsibility. Now, all of a sudden, almost overnight, having lost all of that, being economically insecure, having to start from scratch, a person who may have had a management kind of position, may have been a government bureaucrat, may have been an officer in the army, now in this country sweeping floors as a janitor. The whole collapse of economic security, the collapse of institutions by which your life is regulated, all those things that define what life is for you, overnight gone. Those of us who maybe are a bit older could think back to the plight of the displaced person at the end of World War II. Persons who, by virtue of the redrawing of international boundaries in Eastern Europe, were all of a sudden without a country. They too experiencing the collapse of institutions, the loss of economic security, and so on. As we begin to think of things like that, that might help us develop some kind of appreciation or feeling for those Jews living in Jerusalem and in Judah, who in the space of about 10 years, from 597 to 587, found their world in collapse. The people of Judah existed as an independent country under the leadership of their king in Jerusalem. Even during the days of the mighty empire of Assyria, that Judah's power was sort of restricted, they were a client state, a vassal of Assyria, yet they had their own independence, they had their own institutions, they had their own control over their internal life and so on. But I won't go into detail about all the political happenings, but with the collapse of the Assyrian Empire, Judah was sort of up for grabs and trying to reestablish some alliances with other nations to ensure its security and its future. The king goofed. King Jehoiakim made some wrong decisions. And during that time, the mighty empire of Babylon, who had now moved into the vacuum left by the collapse of the Assyrian Empire, came and dealt harshly with the people of Judah. And so in 597 BC, Nebuchadnezzar took the aristocracy, took the king, Jehoiachin, into exile, plundered the temple, appointed his own puppet as king, a man by the name of Zedekiah. Zedekiah thought he could perhaps sort of rebel against Nebuchadnezzar. He made a mistake as well. And 10 years later, in 587 BC, Nebuchadnezzar came back with his troops, laid siege to Jerusalem, destroyed the city, destroyed the temple, took other citizens of Judah and Jerusalem into exile. References in 2 Kings chapters 24-25 tell us that it was only the poor, only the marginal people were all that were left in the land. Judah was devastated, Judah was wiped out, it was no longer had it any political identity. All those institutions by which the Jews understood their life together, understood their sense of being a nation, being the people of God, all of those institutions were gone. There was no longer a temple. There was no no longer a religious center for the people. There was no longer a king. They had lost all sense of political identity. Nationhood was gone. The priesthood, they were still priests. They were hauled off into exile. But the priests could no longer offer the sacrifice in the temple at Jerusalem. So the whole responsibility of what, you know, what it meant to be a priest was altered. Economic system was in collapse. Only the poor were left. Everything was in ruins. Imagine the trauma if you were a Jew living in Judah, living in Jerusalem at that time. All that through which or by which I understood my identity was gone. Who am I? Who am I as a Jew? Imagine the kind of self-searching, the kind of trauma that those people must have been experiencing and feeling with these events of 597 and 587 BC. And so that's the setting for not only this part of Isaiah, but I think it's worth noting that much of the Bible, much of the Hebrew Bible as we know it, was shaped during that period, during the time of the exile. As various theologians, as various thinkers, as various groups within the Jewish community tried to reassess and interpret and understand that which had happened to us. Genesis through Deuteronomy, as we know it today, was shaped by the events of the exile. The great history that we call the Deuteronomic or Deuteronomistic history, Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, that was edited in its the form in which we meet it today during this time. Other prophets come out of this period, Ezekiel being one. Part of the book of Jeremiah comes from this period. And we could go on and on and on that much of the Hebrew Bible has been stamped by the trauma of the exile as the people tried to understand and interpret and get a handle on that which we have experienced during these years. It's late in this period then that we meet the prophet with whom we will be dealing this week, 2nd Isaiah, the Isaiah of the exile. So the first word of this prophet with which we want to work this week is this passage, Isaiah 40, verses 1 through 11. I've asked you to read that and also to take a look at these other three passages. And to this list of three, I could have added others, but for the sake of time, I'll mention those passages, but you may want to go back and pick those up on your own sometime and compare them as well. But as you looked at these passages, I'd like you to tell me what you saw or what you see. I hope you see some things. It'd be embarrassing if you don't, for me at least. Do you see any patterns or anything like that? All right, we have a sense of call or a sense of commission in each of those. I asked you to look at Jeremiah and Isaiah 6 and Exodus 3. Clearly, passages that deal with prophets whom we know. Moses is the greatest of the prophets in Jewish tradition. The Exodus 3 passage is his experience at the burning bush, where he receives or experiences the call to go down to Egypt to be the agent through which Yahweh will deliver his people from oppression. The Jeremiah 1 passage is the call of Jeremiah to be a prophet. The Isaiah 6 passage is the call of that first Isaiah, Isaiah of Jerusalem, the 8th century Isaiah, to be a prophet as well. So each of those passages, we have this idea of call. Now, within those passages, What are the elements? If you had, I asked you to outline the passage. Obviously, the actual act of calling would be one of the elements in that outline. But what else do you see there in terms of outlining? Right now, let's just stick with those three passages.
Well, a sense of unworthiness on the part of the person being called.
All right, if you look at where the call is expressed, right after that, the prophet or the person raises some kind of objection. Jeremiah, I'm only a youth. I'm just a kid. I'm inexperienced. I'm unworthy of this task, of this responsibility. Isaiah, his sense of unworthiness. I'm a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. Moses has an objection as well. Who am I that I should go down to Egypt to set my people free? Some other passages, the ones that I didn't list, you might want to just make note of these and look them up on your own sometime. In Judges chapter 6, verses 11 to 24, and then Ezekiel chapter 1 through chapter 3, verse 11, similar passages, and we'll see the same elements there as well, of a call or a commission followed by an objection. Judges 6 is the call of Gideon. Gideon is remembered as a judge, not as a prophet, but the structure is the same. Gideon is called to deliver his people from the hand of the Midianites, and Gideon's objection is, well, I'm a member of the clan of Manasseh, or the tribe of Manasseh, and my clan within that tribe is the weakest of all. Who are we that we can deliver Israel from the hand of the Midianites? So there's the call followed by an objection. What other elements in the outline would you want to put in?
I'd say a promise. The promise, the Lord said, I will tell you what to say.
Okay.
Would that be a promise or...
Why don't we call that, to use my word,
reassurance, yeah.
A reassurance. Mm-hmm. That the prophet is called, he objects, but the word from Yahweh immediately after that is one of reassurance. You know, don't worry. After all, who is giving you the power to do this thing but I? You know, I will give you the power. So Yahweh gives this sense of reassurance. As we looked, if we were to look in detail at these passages, in some of them, it's sort of an optional thing, so we'll just put that in parentheses. A sign is given to sort of symbolize or signify that reassurance. That's not there in all of the passages. And if we wanted to complete our outline, begins with some kind of introductory word prior to the call or the commission. The thing about this introductory word is its setting or its context is in what we would call the heavenly court. Now we have to use our imagination here, and this is difficult for moderns living in the Western world, to kind of put ourselves back into the shoes of Israel or other peoples who lived in the ancient Near East. I suppose as we conceptualize heaven, sort of God is alone in heaven. Well, in the ancient world, that wasn't the case at all. Among Israel's neighbors, the Canaanites, the Mesopotamians, heaven was peopled with all kinds of divine beings, all kinds of gods. So you've got these elaborate pantheons or groups of gods of Canaan or of ancient Mesopotamia and so on. Well, Israel shared that conception, but obviously because of the sense of monotheism in ancient Israel, you can't have a pantheon of gods. But in Israel, what happened is that you have the sense of Yahweh as God, as Lord, surrounded by a group of divine beings or heavenly creatures that are largely anonymous. And the heavenly beings sort of wait upon or attend or serve as messengers, as attendants to Yahweh. Yahweh presides over this group of heavenly beings. Later on, when we come down towards the time of the New Testament, in late Jewish thought, the heavenly court becomes the place of origin of Jewish speculation on angels. So you get the identification of archangels, Raphael and Gabriel and Uriel and so on. And there are passages. Let me give you a couple. You might just want to note these. In the Psalms especially, Psalm 82, verse 1, that psalm begins, God has taken his place in the divine council, in the midst of the gods, he holds judgment. That psalm begins with a reference to this idea of the heavenly court, or the heavenly assembly, or the heavenly legislature, if you will. The gods presides over this assembly of divine beings. In the midst of the gods, he holds judgment. Another passage, Psalm 89, verse 7. God feared in the council of the holy ones. Council here referring to that assembly, that grouping again, of the holy ones. There are passages in the book of Job that point to this as well. Also the idea of God presiding over this group of divine beings that wait upon him is the conceptualization that's behind those familiar passages from Genesis 1, 26. Let us make man in our image. Note the plural there. Let us make man in our image. The understanding there is that it's Yahweh speaking to the members of that heavenly assembly. Also, Genesis 11, the Tower of Babel story, the word of Yahweh, let us go down and confuse their language. Yahweh addressing those heavenly beings, the members of his court, the members of his assembly. Well, the point of all this for our passages here is that the call of the prophet takes place in that heavenly setting. So the conceptualization that Israel is working with is that the prophet is one who is privileged to eavesdrop on the proceedings of the heavenly court. The prophet hears Yahweh and his heavenly host, his heavenly assembly, debating the fate of peoples and of nations. I call it a heavenly court. It has that law court kind of dimension to it. I think we need to emphasize that it was in this heavenly assembly, as the way Israel understood it, that Yahweh brought charges against his people for their violation of covenant. They have not kept the covenant. They have not kept the commandments. They've gone off worshiping other gods. They've run after the Baal. They've entered into alliances with Assyria and with Egypt that they ought not to have. And so in that heavenly court setting, Israel, in effect, is on trial for its violations of covenant. And so the prophet then is the one who hears those proceedings and then who is called or commissioned to bear the report, to bear the consequence or the decision of those proceedings to his people. The prophet is the messenger of the court, as it were. And so the prophet's call is in that heavenly setting, the setting of the court. And so we see that in Isaiah 6. Isaiah is in the temple, caught up in the liturgy of the temple. He has this vision of Yahweh. We need to keep in mind the kind of fluidity of the image, that on the one hand, Isaiah is in the temple in Jerusalem, but he's also caught up and swept up in through this vision of what is going on in the heavenly temple. That there's this correspondence between, you know, the earthly sanctuary and the heavenly sanctuary, not only in Israel, but throughout the ancient Near East. And so he's swept up in or caught up in this vision of the heavenly temple. He sees the cherubim, the seraphim calling to each other. The voice of Yahweh of calling, of commission. Who will go for us? Who will be our messenger? Who will carry the proceedings of the court to the people of Judah? And at that point, with the sense of his sin being cleansed, the first Isaiah can say, here I am, send me. The Jeremiah passage, we don't have an explicit reference to that heavenly court setting, but I guess we just have to assume it. But the same kind of dynamic there. Jeremiah, his objection overcome through his reassurance, commissioned to go as a prophet, as the messenger of the heavenly court to his people. We could add the same about Ezekiel. Had the same about the Judges passage, Gideon, the judge. That passage begins with the appearance of the angel. An angel, a member of the heavenly court, who appears to Gideon and so on. The basic passage, though, for all of these, that's behind all of these, is the Exodus 3 passage, the experience of Moses at the burning bush. It begins with this introductory word, the kind of heavenly context, that the burning bush as a symbol of the revelation or the manifestation of Yahweh. And it's that passage that dictates the others, as it were. I guess what I'd like to suggest is the fact that this pattern reappears over and over and over again in and offers the mechanism or the outline for which each of these prophets, or by which each of these prophets expresses or understands or articulates his experience as a prophet, or his experience of a call to be a prophet. Although the details differ, Isaiah's experience is different than Isaiah's experience is different than Jeremiah's experience, and so on. Yet the pattern is the same, and the pattern is always that of the experience of Moses. And so by what is happening is that Jeremiah or Isaiah is saying that my self-understanding as a prophet is that of Moses. That Moses sets the example. He dictates the outline. And part of my credential, or my credential as being a prophet, is that I can say that I have had that same experience that Moses has had. And so each of those prophets quite consciously organizes or outlines the details of their separate experience, each of their separate experiences, into the pattern dictated by Moses himself. Well, that's by way of background. What I'm suggesting for our study this morning is that is the same thing we have in Isaiah chapter 40, those first 11 verses, that passage serves then as the report of the call of this other prophet, this anonymous Isaiah, to be a prophet to his people who languish in exile. And so in the time we have remaining, I'd like us simply to turn to Isaiah chapter 40 and to look at that in a bit more detail. What I'd like to do here is to just outline, using this structure we've detected in these other passages, to match up against that certain verses in Isaiah 40. The introductory word is in the first couple of verses, and let's focus on those first. Comfort, comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem. Cry to her that her warfare is ended, that her iniquity is pardoned, that she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. Now, the thing to note about these couple of verses, if you had the Hebrew text open in front of you, and as you looked at those series of imperatives, comfort, comfort, speak tenderly, cry to her, you'd quickly detect that those imperatives are plural. And so the King James, if you think back to the King James translation, that's a value here. Comfort ye, my people. The word is addressed to a group of people, not just to one person, but to a group. Well, what group are we speaking of? Well, what I'd like to suggest is that the group here represents that heavenly council, that heavenly assembly. And so the setting here is in the heavenly court, Yahweh addressing the members of his assembly, his host, his heavenly army that surrounds him on his throne. He addresses those people who are his messengers, his heavenly messengers, to bear this word of comfort to his people who have spent these many years in exile, to tell Israel, to tell the people of Judah in exile that their iniquity has pardoned, that all that which occasioned the exile at the beginning, the sins of Manasseh the king, that atonement has been made for those, that their iniquity is pardoned, that they have received double. They've made twice the payment for their sins. And so the word goes out to the heavenly assembly to do this. And so at verse 3, we come to the expression of the call. A voice cries. That phrase appears again at verse 6, a voice cries. My suggestion here is that this anonymous voice is a member of that heavenly assembly, that heavenly law court. Maybe more than one voice. Maybe we've got some kind of antiphonal thing going on here, that in verse 3, one voice cries. At verse 6, some other voice in the heavenly assembly speaks out. Well, in verse 3, 4, and 5, a voice cries, in the wilderness prepare the way of the Lord. In other words, the voice speaks out that which is to be addressed to the people in exile. What is the message of comfort that is to be conveyed to them? It's the message, in the wilderness prepare the way of Yahweh. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be lifted up, every mountain and hill be made low. The uneven ground shall become level, the rough places a plain. The glory of Yahweh shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together, for the mouth of Yahweh has spoken. As you hear those verses, what comes to mind?
John the Baptist.
Okay, John the Baptist, this is the verse used then in the New Testament to interpret John the Baptist's ministry. The reference here to wilderness, to highways, to desert, mountains and hills and valleys being transformed, and in that the glory of Yahweh being revealed. Let's put it this way, if you're a Jew in exile, who has been nurtured and grown up in that community on the tradition of the ancestors, the stories of Scripture and so on. As you hear these words, what would come to mind?
Life would be made easy. Get back to their own homeland.
All right, homeland. Where in the tradition has there been passages and words and remembrances about going back to one's homeland?
Well,
the Exodus. If you're a Jew in exile, the story you remember, you know, the basic national story, the story of what it means to be a Jew, what it means to be a member of the people of Israel, is keyed to the remembrance of the Exodus, the Exodus from Egypt. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. It's that event of Exodus is the formative event for ancient Israel. Just as parenthetically, think of these two words beginning with E, Exodus and exile. Those are the two foci, two focal points for the Bible, for the Hebrew Bible, that in one way or another, most of the Hebrew Bible is keyed to those two events, the remembrance of the Exodus, that first great act of liberation, when Yahweh, by his grace, delivered his people from oppression and created a nation out of that, created a new people, brought them to this promised land. And then the exile, the trauma of punishment, as Israel understood it, that the nation was being punished for the sins of its kings, for the sins of the people. That's why they languished in exile. But then beyond that, those voices that said out of exile would come a new exodus, a new beginning, a recreation of the people of Israel. And that's the theme that's introduced here. And so this is the message of comfort that is to be taken to the people, that there will be a new exodus, there'll be a new trip through the wilderness, not from Egypt to Canaan, but this time from Babylon across the desert back to Jerusalem. And the wilderness will be transformed. It will be a miraculous kind of trip, a miraculous journey. Valleys will be lifted up, and mountains and hills be made low. Uneven ground shall become level, rough places a plain. And in this and through this, the glory of Yahweh will be revealed. Just like the glory of Yahweh accompanied the people as they made the first exodus, in the pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night, the revelation of the glory of Yahweh, so too now the glory of Yahweh will accompany his people as he leads them in this new exodus back home to Zion, to Jerusalem. And so that's the message that the voice from the assembly speaks. This is the message of comfort. And at verse 6, a voice says, cry. Cry this message, speak this message. And at that point in verse 6, we get this introduced, and I said. I, that being the prophet. This prophet, this anonymous Isaiah, whose privilege to eavesdrop on the proceedings of the heavenly assembly that day, he says, what shall I cry? I've heard the message that is to be proclaimed, but I feel that it's futile. That's his objection. What shall I cry? All flesh is grass. All its beauty is like the flower of the field. The grass withers, the flower fades when the breath of the Lord blows upon it. Surely the people is grass. The sense of futility that over against the might and power of Yahweh, the futility of proclaiming to this message to those people who languish in exile. But the reassurance is introduced in verse 8, that to be sure the grass withers, the flower fades, when the breath of Yahweh, when the manifestation of the storm wind of Yahweh goes forth. But, as that verse concludes, the word of Yahweh will stand forever. The power of God's word, Yahweh's word, will accomplish these things. And the prophet need not worry about the futility of it all, for the power of the word will accomplish these things. And so, building upon that in 9, 10, and 11, we get the sense of the prophet who has been called to speak this word now in turn calls upon Zion, his people, to in turn pick up the message, to be heralds themselves, to lift up their voices with strength. Lift up, fear not, say to all the cities of Judah, say to all of your people, behold your God, behold Yahweh, your God comes with might. His arm rules for him. Behold, his reward is with him, his recompense before him. He will feed his flock like a shepherd. He will gather the lambs in his arms, carry them in his bosom, gently lead those that are with young. A couple of comments. That very last part of that verse 11, and gently lead those that are with young, at least that's what the RSV says, I think you can make a case that the last half of that line should be something like, and gently comfort those who are with young. That there are grounds for the word there that is translated lead as really being the same word comfort that we met back in verse 1. And if so, that would make a nice device, poetic device in Hebrew poetry, of closing off a passage with words or phrases or images with which you began. And so to teach you a little technical Bible study, so to speak, give you a word for that. Biblical scholars talk about inclusion, that you've got something at the beginning of a passage balancing something at the end of the passage. And so we may have here an example just with that one word, comfort, introduced at one, showing up at verse 11. But beyond that, I'm of the mind that the sense of inclusion in this passage is even more pronounced. Yes, the question. Well, you know, I'd like to, if we could, I don't want to put you off, but put on hold for a moment, kind of Christian interpretation passage. Obviously, these passages, these chapters of Isaiah have been of extreme importance as the Christian community has tried to articulate or interpret the mission and message of Jesus. Reference was made earlier to the use of verses from this very passage in introducing the figure of John the Baptist and so on. When we get to the servant passages, servant of the Lord passages, those have been formative in understanding and interpreting Jesus' ministry and so on. I don't want to put you off, but what I'd like us to do now is simply to kind of work with the passage in its setting or in its context there at the beginning or in the middle of the exile in terms of what the prophet was getting at for his immediate audience. And as we have time later in the week to come back then to maybe how the Christian community has used this material from Isaiah in shaping and informing its interpretation of Jesus. So if you're willing to let that go for a while, we'll try to come back to that. Okay? Thanks. Well, in verses 1, there are all these imperatives. Comfort, comfort my people. Speak to the heart of Jerusalem. Cry to her. Imperatives. If you look down at verse 9, there are a series of imperatives. Get you up to a high mountain, herald Zion. Lift up your voice. Fear not. Speak to the cities of Judah. A series of imperatives here at the beginning, down here at verse 9, followed by, there's a series of that's. Comfort my people and so on. And then in Hebrew, there are three words that are identically the same. That her iniquity is pardoned. That her warfare is ended, that she has received from Yahweh, from the hand of Yahweh, double for all her sins. That. Down here, following this series of imperatives, there are three words in parallel, not that, but have the same sense, of three phrases that begin with behold. So you've got a structure here of some imperatives followed by that, that, that. You've got a structure here of imperatives followed by behold, behold, behold. And what I'm suggesting is that binding of those two together is quite intentional. That we've got that structure at the beginning, this structure at the end, and those balance each other. Then you've got that phrase, a voice cries, and then again a voice cries. And that those two phrases, being introduced with a voice cries, balance each other. And at the very beginning, at the very center, you have a phrase from verse 5 that says, and all flesh together will see that the mouth of Yahweh has spoken. And my suggestion is that that passage, that phrase, is at the very center of the passage, and is sort of the key to the passage. That all of this for which the prophet is being called, that this whole message that he will proclaim in these chapters that follow, point to this fact, that through all of this, all flesh together will see that the mouth of Yahweh has spoken. We'll see that Yahweh's word is all-powerful, that it brings things into creation, that it will recreate and restore and save his people once again. And so that phrase about the mouth of Yahweh has spoken, I think is the kind of the key phrase in the story of the prophet's call, and it's a phrase that will be picked up and developed again and again and again as we move through this passage. So,
but I'd like to make the case for, as an old sheep herder, for leading, because it mentions the shepherd. And I recall in the old days in England, they used to try to hire handicapped people who would walk slowly so that you would lead the sheep gently, not rush them. And that's why I like the word lead there.
The image of shepherd is still there, and I don't think that arguing for the
leading.
Comfort to parallel that, I don't think it destroys that at all.
No.
Well, we'll continue tomorrow. We'll move on with some passages that deal with how the prophet sees Yahweh as creator. But now let's go have our coffee.